KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2016 Portland Veg Fest, Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Portland Veg Fest celebrates plant-based living with food samples, experts, and authors to discuss topics in health, animal welfare, and compassion, chef demonstrations, and more. Again, that's the 2016 Portland Veg Fest, Saturday and Sunday, October 22nd and 23rd at the Oregon Convention Center, Exhibit Hall A, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, the transportation choice of Portlanders since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab has a mobile app that allows you to book a cab with your phone, available at the App Store, Google Play, and at radiocab.net. Or, if you prefer, you can talk to a real person at 503-227-1212.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Hello and welcome to Cutie Pock Talk. We've got a little bit of some technical difficulties that I think are being resolved right now.
Yeah, you're on air.
Yeah, Liam, I think it's getting up. So I would like to welcome you all to Cutie Pock Talk, where we invite you all to sit down and listen to what's happening in our queer and trans community of color out here in Portland. My name is Darian Jones. I'm one of the hosts here today with you all, along with Olivia.
Hey.
As well as Phoenix.
Hello.
And
we've got some feedback. I'm sorry about that, guys. How's this going?
Uh-oh.
All right, I think we're back.
Are we back?
Yeah, I think we're back and we are live.
Talk about spooky.
Yeah, it's that time of year where things just get all out of whack. Oh, man.
Sorry, guys, there was a ghost in the KBOO studio.
Definitely a ghost in here haunting our show. So again, back to those introductions. My name is Darian Jones. I'm here with Olivia.
Hey, guys.
As well as Phoenix Singer.
Hey there.
And Carly Espinoza, who's joining us from the Basic Rights Oregon Equality PAC Board. Carly.
Hey.
Welcome.
Yeah, I'm super excited.
So we've got a really special show for you all this evening. As you all know, it is election night, or actually, sorry, it's get ready to vote night. So
oh
if you haven't
God.
Registered to vote, this is the night to do it because it's your last night to do so.
Yeah, you have to register today, guys.
Yeah, I think it's said there's a deadline, maybe 8 p.m. I think you have to get your ballots or your mail. You have to get your...
You can actually register until 11:59 p.m. tonight.
What?
Online.
Online? Yeah. Is that a low barrier that we have to register to vote here? here in Oregon?
Sure is.
Oh my gosh. I feel like if you Google how to register to vote in Oregon, you'll pop up with some information for you to get registered here. So to kind of kick us off tonight, I think Olivia is going to start with a nice tale of fear. And
elections.
Election fear, I think.
Well, as most of you guys know, I'm welcoming you to the October edition of our show. And if you're following along, this is going to be our Culture of Fear edition as well. Now, October is known as a time in many cultures where the living and the dead approach each other and the worlds kind of blend, especially, you know, around Day of the Dead, Halloween, Samhain, different cultures celebrate that in different ways. And here in the United States, a lot of that coincides with our election. And with a presidential candidacy at hand tonight and this month.
Plus the Oregon election.
Yeah, plus the Oregon election. There's a lot at stake. I'm going to start off with a Hafiz quote. I really love Hafiz. Fear is the cheapest room in the house. I would like to see you living in better conditions. What do we do out of fear? Are we coerced into voting? Are we coerced to not vote? And how does fear affect the American election?
Wow, those were a lot of questions for us. I don't know. Phoenix, how do you feel about fear and voting, especially in a country that we live in that is so primed on democracy? What are your personal kind of understandings of the history of fear, especially when related to voting here?
Well, I think that any conversation around voting and fear really should start around voter intimidation. Now, a lot of people often, maybe because we don't have the best educational system in this country that that's like a really good background in race, a lot of folks don't realize that immediately after the abolition of slavery and the granting of voting rights to black men, that actually there were a series of ways immediately put into effect. Before even the direct segregation laws, things called black codes. Things that would prevent you from being able to vote by labeling you a criminal or a felon after you being arrested. But you would also see people show up at the polls to prevent and intimidate and cause fear in black men who showed up to prevent them from voting, even though it wasn't technically something that we would later see in other legislation that actually explicitly prevented them from voting by law. You would see all sorts of people that would show up specifically to scare away the black electorate.
What do you think is the cause of that kind of fear, Olivia, here? Because, you know, the black codes were kind of implemented in 1865, which is shortly after.
Has anyone here seen The 13th yet on Netflix?
That new amazing film that kind of covers the history of, I guess, the way the legislative system and the judicial system has kind of imprisoned black and brown bodies. That film that's available on Netflix that you can stream.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, clearly we've seen it.
It's really phenomenal.
Have you seen it?
I have not. I'm going to watch it tonight, though.
Okay.
Oh, you should.
I just think it's really a great way to bring us into the modern era, especially around this election, and it gives us some historical context for the fear of, especially the black man in America, the abject, if you will. I think Phoenix can talk a little bit towards that with her background in the abject.
So just a quick language check. Abject, it's like a word used in a lot of like philosophy and theory. It just, it's a word that means neither subject nor object. So this is often used in thinking about, just imagine the scariest monster in a horror film. That's abject. It's not an object, but it's also not really a person. And this is often how we interact with blackness in this country, is by viewing it as abject. And thinking specifically about fear, politics, and the post 13th Amendment in the United States, going off of the 13th, really just thinking about how immediately following the abolition of slavery, there's this new language of criminality that started arising with the black codes, and then with segregation and Jim Crow, and with what many, including Michelle Alexander, would call the new Jim Crow.
The new Jim Crow.
Yeah. Where you suddenly see like this reversing of the language and rhetoric that you used to see around black people under slavery, which was that they were hardworking, they were polite, they followed the rules. That was like a common source of rhetoric. Mm. When slavery was abolished, this became completely reversed. You started seeing understandings of black men as this perverse criminality.
Yeah.
You had all these fears, and for instance, a lot of recent drug laws were passed in passed in this country prohibiting what was previously legal was often because of this fear.
Right.
Cocaine, for instance, was given to black slaves to make them work harder and stronger. Mm-hmm. And after the abolition of slavery, cocaine was still associated with blackness.
Mm.
This is before the 1980s and the huge like white collar, white man executive business takeover aesthetic of cocaine. It was illegalized because they feared that cocaine made men, black men, so manic that they would assault black, like not black women, white women. They didn't care about black women.
Right.
And you could see how this becomes a continuous thread of where certain kinds of behaviors, especially those surrounding drugs, become the source of which you begin punishing black bodies as this source of monstrosity.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I think that that leads to a lot that's very interesting, especially in the current election, and not just the national one, but like the local one, about how what the percentage of Portland voters is.
Right, and the people who actually end up voting, right?
Because how many people will end up voting, and what does voting actually mean?
I think in our state we have like a 50% registration rate, and I think that's
I think it's higher. Yeah,
it's really significant. I think it's due in part, a huge part, to the new motor voter law that was passed.
But how many black people can vote in Oregon?
Right, and so I mean, you know, stemming before we trail off of 13th, the film.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of want to let people know that the film is really based around kind of the 13th Amendment and like a specific clause within that amendment. And so, you know, the 13th Amendment was passed in like 1865, and this was also kind of the same time that like the Black Codes were started.
Mm.
And when you think about it, the 13th Amendment talks about neither slavery nor involuntary servitude. And then there's a clause, which is, except as punishment for crime, wherefore of the party shall be duly convicted, shall exist within the United States.
Right.
And so when you really start to think about these laws and what's hidden behind them, you know, it's just a really different landscape that you start to understand, and how we, for so long, were denied access and understanding, and now it's so important that we all kind of actually engage in that process. And you know, Oregon makes it a really low barrier for people to be able to register in our state here. So if you don't know, tonight is the last night to vote, and you can register online.
Yeah.
I believe if you search the Google for register to vote in Oregon, you'll have a huge little menu that actually will show you if you've actually registered to vote previously or not.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a pretty robust system that we have here. And so kind of thinking about the way that history has kind of worked and through the laws that have been passed, I know it was a segment that we wanted to kind of touch about, which was kind of the rise of the far right. And kind of maybe touching on that for a brief second before our break here. I'd love to get your insights as to like, what do you think kind of cultivated that rise in the far right, just in the positions of like understanding history and how things have played out. And you know, when we say far right, like what do we really mean by far right?
In this case, like alt-right, which is the newest iteration.
What do you mean by alt-right? Like alternative right? Does that mean alternative or
sort of.
Well, this is actually like a huge focus of study for me. And just quickly going through what we mean by the far right.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, we mean something even just beyond a normal or average or everyday kind of right wing.
Right.
So when we talk about the far right, we're really talking about a series of traditions and tendencies that go back to really the French Revolution. You start seeing, as in opposition to the new French values of egalitarianism, brotherhood, fraternity, like this want and need and drive to go back to the monarchy.
Right.
This thing called traditionalism.
Hmm.
This thing that was anti-enlightenment. It was anti-left and anti-liberal. So as liberalism and the left become distinct and separate political categories, like the far right have been opposed to both of them.
Hmm.
We can see also in the 1930s and 40s with the rise of fascism, this really takes traditionalism and elevates it to a new sense of mass politics, where we can see in Mussolini's Italy or Hitler's Germany, where we see this really strong patriarchal, explicitly white nationalist, anti-capitalist, anti-left politics.
And so when you say patriarchal,
yes.
Can you explain that to our listeners out there?
Oh, yeah. Just the belief that men should dominate women
mm-hmm.
and should have power over women in all facets of life, that women should be subservient.
Hmm. What's your input on this, Olivia?
Well, I think I'm coming to this from a modern or like contemporary perspective. And so my reporting in the past year for local news and other stuff has sort of seen the rise of the Trump campaign and what happens at that campaign and how fear plays into who believes what and why. And I think that for the far right, there's kind of a constant fear of the other that's being created to allow that fear to continue.
What about you, Carly? You've been silent a little bit over there. I'm sorry I haven't reached out to you. How do you feel about fear and the way it plays out through our political system here?
Yeah, I absolutely think fear plays a huge part in our election process, in voting, in registering to vote. I think we're often told, in my experience, I think we're often told, basically, you know, very much what Phoenix was saying, I think, about this idea that we see of white power and mm-hmm. this ability to kind of keep people of color, LGBTQ folks, women down, and it's working, and it seems to be working, and it's unfortunate. Right. And that's what, you know, I've been thinking about a lot lately.
Totally, totally. I mean, that's definitely that's the reality of it, right? I mean, if you look at the kind of way a bunch of our laws work here in this country now, people are still denied access.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's a report about last year how there's still a school segregated in the South. And I'm like, you know, so people think these things have stopped when they really haven't.
Segregated proms.
Right. Yeah. And that's totally okay.
And
right?
We're segregated in Portland in the terms of AP classes, tracking.
Absolutely.
I'd love to. Yeah. I'd love to get.
Sorry, that's a whole nother can
of
worms.
Yeah. And I'd love to engage in that, but we're actually due for our break here. And following this break, we're going to touch up with Carly here on some of the endorsed candidates that the Basic Rights Oregon Equality PAC Board has selected, as well as some of the ballot measures that are currently on the Oregon ballot here that you can vote on November 8th. Because if you didn't know, tonight is the last night that you can register to vote here in the state of Oregon, and it's pretty low barrier. If you go on to Oregon, Google register to vote in Oregon, and it'll show up, I promise you, because I'm doing it right now. So on that note, we're going to take us to our first break here in 3, 2, 1.
Es una jornada que si me enfoco lo logro, si me dedico lo aplico. La luz del alma me guía, la llevo por vigía. Ha dado un giro el corazón, limpiándome de la niebla que hay en la razón. No me arrepiento de nada, tengo una corazonada. No me arrepiento de nada.
Those were the beautiful sounds of Edna Vasquez. Welcome back to Cutie Pog Talk. I'm here, Darian Jones, with Olivia, Phoenix Singer, and our special guest today, Carly Espinoza, who's here with us from the Basic Rights Org, Oregon Equality Pack. And for those of you who do not know about the Equality Pack of Basic Rights Oregon, the Equality Pack is a nonpartisan political action committee dedicated to electing pro-equality elected officials. And they focus on statewide and legislative offices where they are proud to endorse, re-endorse actually, the new incumbents who are 100% pro-equality for the voting record. So Carly, thank you for being here with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
Of course, yeah. So who are some of these awesomely pro-equality candidates that I think we should all know about?
Yeah, so we have so many. So there are literally, there's like 67 candidates that have been endorsed this cycle through Bro. And we actually have 9 out LGBTQ identified candidates on the ballot.
Oh, wow. That's quite a number.
Yeah, it's huge.
Is that the largest in what you could call history here, or gay history?
It's definitely the largest in Oregon.
Oh, that's awesome.
Including 2 out POC folk.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, Paul Southwick, who's running for House District 37 in Tualatin, West Flint. And then Greg Delgado, who's running for the Senate, Senate in Senate District 27, which is Bend, Redmond area. Yeah. And then obviously the big, well, in a lot of ways, we think the big ticket is definitely Governor Brown, who is running for election.
Governor Kate Brown?
Governor Kate Brown.
Is she pro-equality?
She sure is. She's an out LGBTQ-identified person.
That is pretty phenomenal here.
She's an incumbent. Who is she running against?
She's running against Bud Pierce.
Who's that?
I don't know a lot about him, and I don't want to say much bad things.
Okay. No, totally.
I just wanted to. So, what about her? Can we get some background?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the background?
So, Kate Brown. Obviously, we know she was Secretary of State. And then became governor. When Kit Sopper resigned, Kate Brown actually, she's been in office for 20 months, I think, total, February of last year. Mm-hmm. And she would actually be the first governor elected governor in the country.
Wow, yeah. That's national news, it sounds like. Oh my
huge
goodness.
Huge breaking news right here, right now. That's probably not true. No, she would be the first elected governor. And
what do you think makes Governor Brown super quality?
I think her track record of so many amazing things. You know, there was a article that came out that was like 18 things in 18 months.
Uh-huh.
You know, she, you know, something that was near and dear to our hearts at Bro was she signed the ban on conversion therapy.
Yeah, that was a huge Jissel win for everyone.
I remember Paul Southwick actually testifying to that.
Yeah, right. Paul Southwick testified.
It was a very moving testimony if anyone heard it.
Yeah. You know, implemented paid sick leave.
Right. Sounds like a lot of
wage. Amazing great things wins. That she's done in her, you know, less than 2 months? Years. Yeah, that she's been in office.
That's interesting. So who are some of the other candidates that you are also endorsing through the Equality PAC board here?
Yeah, so another great candidate who's running for election as an out candidate, Karen Power, who is running for House District 41. I'm really excited that I get to cast my ballot for her because she will be my state representative. Fingers crossed.
That's interesting. Yeah, I believe I met Karen about a week ago at the Coming Out monologues, which were phenomenal. That happened on Coming Out Day last week, hosted by Basic Rights Oregon.
Nice.
And that was a really impactful, eye-opening, and powerful performance.
Yeah. So. Yeah, she was amazing. And, you know, we have nine out candidates, we have so many candidates that are dedicated allies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the race that I'm watching, there's two races that I'm really interested
in. Oh, yeah, tell us about those.
The Secretary of State's race, Brad Avakian.
Oh, yeah, Brad.
Yeah, he's, I think... The office of Secretary of State is so important because, as we learned last year, it's the second in line for if something was to happen to the governor. You know, the Secretary of State is then becomes the governor, and you know, we need someone in that office who, you know, is supportive of all of our all the issues that matter.
Well, it seems like having two PAC board endorsed candidates here is a great kind of lineup to think about equality in the state and kind of what that it looks like. So it seems like Basic Rights Oregon has a great list of people here, which I'm not. Gosh, the list is just so long that I have. There's like maybe 40 people
there's
on
67,
here. 67. Wow.
Endorsed candidates. One other candidate I really want to flag just really quickly is, as an amazing ally, is Teresa Alonzo Leon, who's running for House District 22.
Oh.
it's Woodburn. And something... Something that's so important for Teresa is she would actually... So House District 22 is the only district in the state where people of color are in the majority.
Oh, wow.
And whoa,
is that Woodburn,
in
you say?
Oregon?
Yeah, in Oregon.
Wow.
And she would be the first person of color elected to represent that district.
That's so interesting when you think about representation of your community and having a person of color actually elected for a community that sounds primarily of people of color. That's wow, that's really powerful. And that they're pro-equality
as
well.
That's such a basic thing.
That's getting me excited.
Wow, to be able to be represented by the people that actually make up that community.
Right. Absolutely. It's such an interesting thing when we see people who look like us in power, right? And how that impacts the way we interact with the world and the way we grow and change and develop. And so, you know, I think definitely having, you know, a nice array of candidates, specifically those who are kind of seeking the betterment of all people, specifically for us, all Oregonians, I think is something that is definitely necessary for our current climate that we're living in, especially as our population grows towards a different demographic than
Absolutely.
What's kind of in the majority right now. These are really phenomenal candidates I see. I also see Lou Frederick on here as well, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Such a great guy.
Can I add something about Lou Frederick that I remember? You guys remember how that marijuana legislation passed here? Obviously, it made marijuana legal in the United States.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Was that Measure 98?
I may have heard this.
You may have heard
that. Is it
that
legal to smoke cannabis in Oregon?
Okay, well, who is it legal for and who benefits from it? That was the thing. Uh-huh, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the 13th, how some laws just really leave some people out.
Right.
And while I was really excited to see prohibition on marijuana end in the state of Oregon, not the United States, sorry. Sorry, guys. I was really excited to see that Lou Frederick stepped up and kind of put forward some work on that. So Lou Frederick was the one to say, hey, what about these people with convictions who are living with that.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
We've used marijuana to instill fear against black men for so long that Lou Frederick's work to undo some of that harm is inspiring. Yeah,
it's history making. It sounds like
absolutely. Yeah, Lou has always been an amazing champion for so many causes that are near and dear to, I think, our hearts. So I'm so honored that we were able to endorse him again. And
I am super excited for the next kind of cycle to kind of take its wings here and really see some of the statements from these candidates that are running right now. I know last year the election time was really, really interesting here in Portland. Mm-hmm. And I'm super excited for the list of candidates that we have kind of running right now. And then on that note, I believe we're going to take you to our next break here. And when we get back, we're going to begin a little bit deeper conversation about these measures in Oregon and kind of the 7 that we got, 94-100. What do they mean? How do we feel? Maybe you'll figure out how you feel and where to go from that. So in 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, it's like crazy.
On those sweet, sweet sounds, we are back here with you all to kind of chat with you about the current election cycle and also let you know that tonight is the last night to vote here in Oregon. Today is, I think, October 18th.
It's October 18th. And the registration deadline
is 11:59 p.m. online or 8 p.m. at the mailing ballot boxes here in the city. So if you haven't already Googled how to vote in Oregon, please go online and Google register to vote in Oregon, and I promise you, you will have options at least until 11:59 p.m. tonight. So back on that, while we're kind of talking about the ballot measures, we're going to kind of let you all know what is on the ballot, right? You know, what can you vote on? What are the measures that are in place? So to kind of keep it straightforward, I'm going to be reading some of the language that is actually listed on it. So we're going to first start off with ballot 94, as some of you might know as the Judicial Retirement Amendment. The purposes of the amendment to Oregon Constitution to prohibit legislative assembly or individuals from fixing age or mandatory retirement of judges. So essentially, this measure amends part of an amendment that caused for it's actually in the Oregon Constitution, Article 7, Section 1A, that allows judges or requires judges to be removed from requires that they retire from office at the age of 75. So basically, this law, if you voted yes on it, would remove that requirement, remove the mandatory requirement that judges retire at age 75. And so kind of feeling like, you know, people at the age of 75, how do we feel? Should they still be able to hold these offices? Because, you know, that's a lot of history that will be lost, right? You know, a lot of people who've seen the way the laws play on our system who actually still are making meaningful impacts. But at the same time, you know, how long is too long for you to run an office as a judge? And, you know, is it time for you to kind of offer that seat up to other people? So kind of like understanding the issues, what are your understandings of the ballot measure. Who would like to start with my question here? Carly, you're looking feisty. What are you thinking?
This ballot measure, when I looked at it originally, I was like, okay, yes, pretty cut and dry. And now I'm starting to have mixed feelings about it.
Oh, okay.
Because my initial reaction was, you know, that, you know, they've worked really hard for this office, you know, schooling and then, you know, working to be become a judge.
It's difficult.
And so when I think about that, I'm like, you know, let them, you know, they should be able to, you know, hold that position as long as possible.
As quoted by a judge, Mercedes Diaz in the Oregonian, she, quote, would very much like to stay and when she's ready to retire, would retire.
And it's a matter of, like, you know, these people who have dedicated sometimes their lives to this profession of law, you know, to then suddenly, you know, kick them out, for lack of a better word, is rough. But at the same time, then I think about, you know, what law, you know, I think about, you know, yeah, where you draw the line at, you know, at knowledge, at all of the things. And I think knowledge is a lifetime thing. You're constantly learning. But
definitely.
Then I think, is 75, you know, should you retire? Like, I don't know if, you know, a judge at 90, you know, and I don't want to speak poorly or about people in our legal system, but I think, you know, I think at 90, are you competent enough, for lack of a better term, to make these rulings? And I don't know.
That's an interesting question.
Olivia, go for it. I wanted to jump in because I found this really interesting, and I was like, is Oregon, you know, normal in having a mandatory retirement age, and what kind of states have mandatory retirement ages, and what kind of challenges have they seen? So it looks like there are some states with no mandatory retirement age, but a lot of those states are, I don't know, for lack of a better word, they seem to be otherwise, like, They're Colorado, Alaska, Alabama. Sorry, wait, my bad. Update. Alabama has a mandatory retirement age of 70. Alaska also does. So the places with no retirement ages, sorry, are, sorry, I had it mixed up. They're California, Delaware, Georgia, Idaho. And there was a 2013 court challenge in the Pennsylvania court saying that it was discriminatory, under equal protection due to clauses in the 14th Amendment mm-hmm. to force someone mm-hmm. to retire
right.
or call them incompetent due to age.
Right. And, you know, when you start thinking about the way our laws work and kind of like what's...
those were dismissed.
What's equitable? What's equitable and what's equal, right? You know, is it equitable to keep people on past this age? Is it equal to reject people at a certain age?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be a really big decision that Oregonians mm-hmm. are going to have to make here, and really trying to really figure out, you know, like, how do we want to be viewed as a state? You know, do we want to have mandatory retirement laws on our judges here in the state, or do we not want that? So it's really, I think, people having to do a lot of research on kind of maybe looking at the demographics of age in our current Oregon kind of judges, right? Like, what is the median age for judges in Oregon? And what are the demographics of those? And kind of how long are those people in place? And, you know, also, are they reflective, too, of, like, the growing change, the way that Oregon has grown? And looking at ways to really make our legislative and judicial system more reflective of Oregon, I think as a whole is maybe what this is seeking to do. Mm-hmm. But I think only Oregonians are going to have the power to do that. And on that note, we're kind of going to have to shift over to another measure. We're going to be looking here at Measure 95, which it's called the Public University Investments, right? Which is really interesting, especially the language. The official title allows investments in equities by public universities to reduce financial risk and increase investments to benefit students. And specifically, the financial impact that has been kind of outlined by the Oregon Financial Estimate Committee is that there is no financial impact on either state or local government expenditures. But what this would allow is for public universities to purchase stocks. And so that's stock. That's like privately traded stock. How do we feel about...
Could that be a conflict of interest?
I'm not sure. Currently, if this measure passes, the Oregon Constitution would be amended to allow public universities to invest in equities, stocks. If no, the measure fails, Oregon Constitution will remain unchanged, and the prohibition against public universities investing in equities will remain in place.
I think my concern, just hearing that for the first time, would be like, okay, so... You know, you're at, let's say you were at Oregon State University and this had passed and the university decides to invest in Coca-Cola, and suddenly, you know, maybe you're going to have a lot less access to other drinks, or you won't be able to, I don't know, buy competing Pepsi products on campus. But I think that's already kind of true in some universities. I don't know if that's true in public ones.
Well, I think probably a bigger concern going... expanding on the idea of a conflict of interest is more that since the passage of SB 270 in 2013, University of Oregon, Oregon State University, and Portland State University now have board trustees, which are made up of private individuals, oftentimes business leaders in the local area.
Right.
So I'm just wondering who is deciding which stocks are going to be mm-hmm. invested in? Is it going to be the board of trustees? And is that a conflict of interest?
Right. And what does that stock look like? And, you know, specifically, this ballot measure would impact Eastern Oregon University, Oregon Institute of Technology, Oregon State University, Portland State University, Southern Oregon University, University of Oregon, and Western Oregon University. So those are the specifically impacted organizations by this ability to kind of engage in the process that allows them to buy equities, which is stock in companies that they could benefit from. Or not. right? It's really dependent on, you know, what's the benefit to Oregon students? Is it more of a financial risk? And really, how do we calculate risk? And I think Oregon voters are going to have a really difficult time with this decision, right? And really understanding, you know, do you want to allow your public university to invest in what is kind of viewed as the private market? Stock exchange. And so what does that mean for education in this school? Will education standards increase, or will school revenue just increase? Will what does that investment look like?
Would tuition go down?
And I think, so that's the argument that I think for instance, the League of Women Voters was saying is there's no guarantee that additional income from equities would provide tuition relief. To students.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And that potentially universities would need to hire expensive investment advisors. I haven't made up my mind. I don't know how I feel. I need to dig deeper.
The financial impact that's outlined from the committee is that the revenue and expenditures impact on public universities is dependent upon decisions made by each university and the type of amount of private equity in which they choose or choose not to invest in return to those investments. So it's kind of really, you know, it's really going to be up to those, you know, of the institutions that we kind of outlined. It's going to be their decisions on what to do with that investment. So it's really giving them the go card to say, yeah, you can now invest in these, but you really have free for all what you want to do with it. Like you, so really, you know, kind of, I think we're, as Oregonians, we're going to have to take a deeper look at this ballot measure and kind of really investigate what we think the best kind of outlook on for our audience, or for our Oregonians and our society. And so, to kind of keep us moving here, I'm not sure if we're going to be able to kind of engage in that break here, because I know we're kind of rounding down the time and we really want to get through all these ballot measures here.
Totally. Sorry for slowing us down.
No one slowed us down. This has just been a fruitful conversation here. And just to keep it going, we're looking now at ballot measure 96, which is the lottery funds for veterans. It kind of dedicates 1.5% of the state lottery net proceeds to funding support services for Oregon vets. The financial impact is that approximately $9.3 million a year would be transferred into the Veteran Services during the fiscal years of 2017 to 2019. These dedicated funds could be from the lottery and would not change the amount of revenue constitutionally consistently dedicated to other purposes. So basically, I think, Carly, you've got a lot of insight potentially on this issue and maybe have some understandings about what does a yes vote look like and what does a no vote look like for this?
Yeah, so I think, for me, when we look at the state budget, you know, currently 33% of the state lottery's revenue is actually dedicated to specific purposes.
Oh, wow.
Including education and state parks. And the remaining 67% as it is undedicated in the state. Has historically allocated this undedicated portion towards economic development, and the many forms that looks like. And so I think when I look at Measure 96, which is 1.5% dropping the undedicated portion from 67 to 65.5, I think about the fact that actually dedicating this percentage to veteran services may actually increase Oregon's eligibility for available federal matching funds.
Oh, wow.
And we're talking about...
what does that mean, affect the availability for federal matching funds?
So I believe, don't quote me, I'm not a money expert, nor do I play one on TV, but or radio as it may be. But I think... dedicating a specific amount of money to veteran services, which I don't believe we currently do, would then open the door for funds federally that are dedicated to veteran services. And we're talking about this money would go to veteran services like assistance with accessing state and federal benefits, reintegration, employment, education, housing, the whole host of things that veterans may need.
Right.
And I don't, you know, and then there's the the argument on the other side that taking away from the funds that the state has to at its disposal to allocate to different places as it sees fit can bring up some concerns. But I think 1.5% is a good amount, and it would bring what you said, 9 million?
Yeah, I mean, it's a significant number to be able to kind of support our veterans, right? Which I think is a big priority for many Oregonians here, and kind of being able to support our community in that way. And I think the Oregon, you know, population is going to have a really difficult time potentially deciding, you know, how they want to use these funds and like, do they want to support the veteran population with our lottery funds with approximately 1.5% or $9 million. And, you know, kind of, I think taking maybe a more in-depth look at what those funds would actually go to specifically, would they maybe support more jobs that have like LGBTQ veterans in the state, you know, because they're, you know, I think we're kind of a national model in that kind of way and other ways. So yeah, I definitely think that Measure 96 will be a point of contingency for many Oregonians, definitely.
Absolutely.
And then now we're kind of gonna move on to some of the higher priorities that have been going on. There is what we have now, ballot measure 97, which is the Oregon corporate tax increase, which is increases corporate minimum taxes when sales exceed $25 million. And these funds, with this colon, that would go education, healthcare, senior services. Mm-hmm. And the measure is statutory amendment placed on the ballot by an initiative petition that apparently... not 100,000 people signed. I only see 99,272. So we're almost at 100,000 people who signed that. So that's a lot of people still. Nevertheless, 800 short of 100,000 people who have signed this petition. So Carly, do you want to talk? Do you have more insights that you would like to continue? Or?
Yeah, so I think... So Measure 97, if it passes, would...
Yeah, I can give a little bit more info about that there is a $548 million that would be created from this from January 1st to June 30th and approximately $3 billion beginning after that. And those are kind of the funds that would then be allocated to the different services such as education, healthcare, and senior services.
Yeah, so I think a yes vote would mean... more money for these services. You know, I think it's 2.5% over $25 million. Business done in Oregon. There are definite arguments and challenges to the measure around whether or not those costs would be passed on to consumers. Mm-hmm. How it would affect farmers, small businesses. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I have my own personal opinions, I think. The measure would, I mean, definitely, we know, like the facts are, we know that we are operating at a deficit in education, healthcare, and senior services. So.
And I do want to, I don't know if Olivia and Phoenix have some input they want to offer, but I do want to say that I believe that Oregon is around the bottom three in the education graduation rates.
We are lowest.
We just moved up to four.
We're the fourth lowest
down
now.
Down from four.
That's awesome.
Got the wrong way.
And
wrong way.
Also, when you think about, you know, corporate tax, the matter of fact is we have one of the lowest corporate tax.
50th. We are dead last in corporate taxes.
So I know one of the lowest was like trying to be high, but we are the lowest. And really when you think about it, where do we see the benefit to Oregonians, right? You know, where does that benefit go? And if the measure has proposed components that will benefit Oregonians, I guess it's really just understanding how we all view those components, right?
I think the really interesting and compelling part about this legislation that I'm reading here is that it would be taxing sales, not profits. And I think that's a really important distinction, because a lot of companies, as we probably know, have the ability to just put their profits elsewhere. So they'll hide money overseas. They'll use different kinds of tactics to put their money in interesting places. But sales are not something you want to minimize, because sales are going to happen in the state in front of people, and you need your investors to know what kind of sales numbers you have. So you can't just report one sales number and then another.
Right.
It's a little bit trickier. And so I appreciate that about this legislation, is that it focuses on things we can see that can't be hidden.
Absolutely.
And I think that that cap too would prevent it from necessarily targeting smaller businesses, because it's really going for those high-end money makers.
Right, over $25 million, which is a huge revenue, right? Yeah. And most small businesses that aren't considered small at that kind of number.
And I think there are some studies that are showing that, that are estimating like less than 1% of Oregon businesses doing business in Oregon would be affected.
Totally. And I think the Oregon voters are going to have a really, really tough decision on this ballot measure, specifically in kind of, you know, how they see it benefiting the community and how they see it impacting their daily life. So I definitely think this is going to be a really tough issue for Oregon voters to vote on. But if you get registered to vote tonight by 11:59 p.m. online, or by taking your ballot measure to that ballot box by 8 p.m., you will be able to cast your vote on these important issues. And so with that said, we've got two more issues here we're going to look at. We're going to next move on to ballot measure 98. And ballot measure 98 is the Oregonians for High School Success. Basically, it requires state funding for dropout prevention, career and college readiness, and programs in Oregon high school students. Wow, these sound like programs a lot of people could benefit from, don't they? Wow. And it looks like this petition had, they have over 100,000 validated signatures. So just so you know, Oregon corporate tax, you got really put it in the water here with the Oregonians for High School Success. So thinking about Oregonians getting successful after they graduate, or maybe getting to graduation and preventing dropout rates, career and college readiness, how do we feel about ballot measure 98? Granted, we only have like a minute to cast our feelings here. And I'll let, you know,
I'm really excited to see that there's a measure that's addressing what we were just talking about, that low graduation rate that's going on here in Oregon. And I think the other thing about how much money Oregon spends on average per student, it's less than $10,000.
Wow.
But the average across the United States is $10,700.
Absolutely.
How do we have one of the lowest rates then, if we spend the average?
Because we're not investing in our students.
In our students. We're not putting that money to good use, like actual programs to help prepare kids for college.
Oregon spent, and I'm quoting a statistic here on Ballotopedia, $9,543 per student in the 2012-2013 year, whereas other states averaged about $10,700. Those states obviously saw, you know, what they paid for. So I think that we could probably benefit from putting a little bit more effort.
I'm super interested to see the reflection of our graduation rates be the same kind of indication of the amount that we're spending, because I think if we're in the median population for the spending, then our kind of graduation rate should reflect that, right?
And I think
and what's the disparity in between those two numbers?
Yeah, and I think they do, in a sense of like, we know, so for instance, for that school year, it was, our graduation rate was much lower. Can I flag something really quickly?
Yeah.
Not telling anybody how to vote. I do want to say there are arguments out there that if that Measure 98 would be the viability of Measure 98 being funded would come into question around Measure 97.
Totally. And I think Oregonians are going to have to place a lot of these ballot measures side by side to really understand the full implications of the impact of a yes vote or a no vote. And to kind of get to these last two ballot measures we're looking at here, we got ballot measure 99, which is the Outdoor School Education Fund, which is an outdoor school fund that continuously funded through the lottery to provide outdoor school programs statewide. Over 93,000 Oregonians kind of signed this. And if approved, up to 4% or $5.5 million from the Oregon Lottery would be transferred quarterly to support the education fund. And so, you know, this is ballot measure 98 here for Oregonians to vote on. And I know we're kind of running short on discussion time, so we can't really hop too far into the weeds about it. But I just want to let all the listeners know out there, you definitely should really, really look at your pamphlet and kind of go in depth with the way the descriptions are given to you and really look at the overall impact and kind of how you think this is really going to benefit all Oregonians. And to kind of round us out, we're going to go to the final ballot measure, which is ballot measure 100, the Wildlife Tracking Prevention Act, which prohibits the purchase or sale of parts or products from certain wildlife species, expectations, and civic penalties. This measure is a statutory amendment if placed on the ballot measure by the initiative petition that had about 88,000 signatures. So the estimated cost of it is less than $100,000. Is that something that we think we should do for Oregon funds? We're going to have to leave it up to you, the Oregon voters, to decide. So that's, again, Wildlife Tracking Prevention Act, ballot measure 100. Oregonians, you've got your civic duty to do. So if you haven't registered to vote, think about it, because you can still vote until 11:59 p.m. tonight.
It's about 5 hours.
And if you want to mail your ballot, you still got 1 hour left. So on that note, this is Cutie Park Talk, and we're signing off.
Thank you. Bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.